Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Don and Duke.
Say hello to my little podcast. The Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Don with me. Donny boy. We're still on our Bands Across America trip, headed to Florida. How you feeling about that today?
Sweaty, sticky. Mm-hmm.
Mosquitoes just stuck to your sweaty skin. They keep slipping around. Can't even get that proboscis in. Love saying that word. That's their pointy nose thing for everyone. So this is, of course, the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums and the album format, talking about them, loving them, obsessing, driving wedges in our other relationships in life. Just kidding. And we've got a great show for you today. Of course, we are continuing on our summer road trip, visiting a different state each episode. And we're headed to Florida. So we'll each be presenting an album by an artist or band that came from Florida.
The proboscis of America.
Yes. The proboscis of America.
The proboscis.
Don, of course, will be asking us the deepest of questions. We'll have some shout outs to some other albums and album related items we're digging, new releases, that kind of thing. And then we will spin that wheel of musical discovery to find out where we'll be going on our next episode. But this week, welcome to Florida.
Road trip! That's what I'm talking about!
Florida, known as the Sunshine State, boasts a vibrant history shaped by Spanish exploration, diverse cultures, and rapid modern growth. Its top attractions include world-famous theme parks like Walt Disney World, stunning beaches, and the unique Everglades National Park. As a musical hub, Florida has produced global stars across genres, from Miami's Latin pop and hip-hop scene to Jacksonville's legendary Southern rock. Whether you seek adventure, relaxation, or a taste of vibrant culture, Florida warmly invites you.
So, Don, we don't really talk about this much. If we've literally been to these states, have you been to Florida?
Just once, to visit my grandfather who lived in Naples.
Okay. Yeah, I was in the Tampa area because we did the Gulf of America, did the coast. Musical artists in Florida, there are quite a few, many very important to the growth of music in America. We, of course, have Ray Charles, who was born in Georgia, but he was raised and musically influenced in Florida, even though he has Georgia on his mind, not Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. On a more modern note, Ariana Grande was born in Boca Raton, pop superstar, featured in Fortnite, so that's how you know they made it. Lynyrd Skynyrd, Southern rock, originating in Jacksonville. Allman Brothers Band, formed in Jacksonville in 1969, but based out of Macon, Georgia. That Florida-Georgia line keeps coming into play. Boy bands, Backstreet Boys, NSYNC. Okay, O-Town, I'll give you a wink.
98 degrees, maybe? I don't know if they were or not.
I think it would have to be 101 degrees if they were formed in Florida. It's pretty hot there. Flo Rida, clever name. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's a rapper out there called Nevada or something like that.
Georgia.
There you go. We got Pitbull, Miami native, hip-hop icon. Rick Ross, Miami rapper.
Rick Ross.
Limp Bizkit, nu metal. Made a mark. You love them, hate them, whatever. They are important to the rock sound of the late 90s, early 2000s. T-Pain, Tallahassee auto-tune innovator, which I guess that's something to be proud of. And then a whole bunch of others. Late 90s, early 2000s, hit makers, Matchbox 20, Creed, Shinedown, Trivium, metalcore from Orlando. So yeah, a whole lot of metal, hip hop, Southern rock, so many things to choose from. We want to tell the story of Florida the best we could, so we've got our albums queued up. The tank is full and Florida's ahead of us. Let's roll out with our cha-cha-cha choices.
You choose me?
It's time to shake your body. All right, well, my...
shaking.
My pick for an album from Florida comes from the Miami Sound Machine with their album Primitive Love, released in August 1985. It's their ninth studio album and their second English language album. They were formed in Miami in 1975. Actually, a large group of people. I'll run through some of the names. The one people probably are most familiar with is Gloria Estefan.
Sure.
Do you say Estefan or Estefan?
I heard it both ways over the years. Let's just say Gloria E.
Yeah, Gloria E. and actually, her husband, Emilio Estefan Jr., is the producer of this record. You know, so one of the main creative forces in the band. Juan Marcos Avila on bass, Enrique Kiki Garcia on drums. He's actually one of the rare drummers that does a lot of songwriting, kind of like Phil Collins, I guess. And I don't know. Wesley B. Wright on guitar.
Love it.
Roger Fisher on keyboards, Betty Cortez, background vocals and keyboards, and Rafael Padilla on percussion. So a big group of people creating Latin-centric pop music, basically, and dance music.
I saw a behind the music about them years ago, and I feel like they were sort of on that hotel circuit, you know?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, as a band like that in the Miami area, which is so tourist-centric, that you would end up playing gigs like that.
Yeah.
And so they had quite a bit of, you know, Latin American success and sort of, you know, fringe U.S. success. But, you know, they really cracked the charts on this album. Let's start it off with the opening cut. Here's Body to Body.
Yeah, it's just so, it's so 80s that I just picture the like jazzercise aerobics tapes of the time and like people dancing around in the leotards with the butt thong thing over the leotard, you know?
I picture like the Getting It Done montage in the 80s, you know, when they got to clean up the house or they got to, you know, create something, you know, they always play some fun song like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Very much, you know, very 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Body to Body was written by Susan Carr, Lawrence Dermer, and Joe Galdo, who actually get songwriting credits on a lot of the album. But this, you know, starts off the, you know, the album. It's very upbeat, kind of, you know, typical romance, attraction and closeness, intimacy. I don't feel a lot of Latin rhythm in this one as much as other tracks. But what did you think of this first track?
I mean, of course, I'm familiar. I was a little kid, but familiar with this sound and this band. And my parents had a couple of their cassette tapes. Not this particular album, I don't think, but that song, when I started the album, I'm like, what? Because it just sounded so generically mid-80s synthy pop. Not synth pop, but synthy club pop, maybe. High energy, but it's flirtatious and kinetic, and it does set the tone for most of what you're getting on this record. So it's a fine opener. Again, I'm trying to keep it in the context of what this is and when this was and when this is.
Okay, well let's hear another cut. Here's Conga.
Can't forget that one. That was everywhere.
Yes, it was. So Congo was written solely by Enrique Kiki Garcia, who was the, again, one of the percussionists in the band. Kind of a typical dance number where you're sort of encouraging people to get on the floor and do some sort of dance, kind of similar to Chubby Checker and The Twist. This is the Latin version.
Was there some sort of set of moves for the conga, or was it just...
Yes, that I don't know. I don't know if that's more just the style of music
or swing and a miss. Insightful question, horrible answer.
So, you know, again, like a lot of disco, you know, it's emphasizing dance, the freedom and sort of losing control of your body on the floor. You know, that's always the spirit of dance music. You've got some references to the rhythm of the island and sugar cane being so sweet.
So we're talking Cuba?
I assume so. Yeah.
So this does, again, fuse that Latin percussion with synth pop. This sound was definitely unique to my ears at the time, and I think to traditional mainstream radio. This song was the first taste of Latin-centric pop music, and I think probably is what cracked the egg to get things going for several years later, 15 years later, when we had that Latin explosion in the late 90s, early 2000s.
The Ricky Martin and the Mark Anthony, Enrique.
Yeah, I think Miami Sound Machine has cracked that door open on the larger scale. And it was just slow burn from that point on. But, you know, although one could say that Julio Iglesias, at least on the on the more adult contemporary pop charts, was getting that going as well. But this song was everywhere, whatever summer it was. I remember it being on constantly. Very prolific.
And the mid-80s really kind of Miami, for some reason, became a bigger, you know, part of the culture, which we'll probably talk about later.
In the mid-80s is when the 80s became the 80s, when the hair got big and the colors got really neon. As we're heading into 85 or so, things really started to take on what we now, you know, like on shows like the Goldbergs, what we now showcase is what the 80s were like.
The white sport coat with the sleeves rolled up and you're at the pants, you know, high water style. All right. Well, was there a track from the album you wanted to discuss?
I tend to lean towards Gloria Estefan's singing voice when she really gets to sing, and that happens mostly on ballads, you know, the less conga-based songs. So why don't we listen to a little bit of Words Get in the Way. So this one was released in June of 86 as the third single, written by Gloria. The ballad marked a stylistic shift for the band, showcasing that versatility and kind of beyond the Latin dance hits. Peaked at number 5 on the Billboard Hot 100, number 1 on the Adult Contemporary chart. This is probably the one that got my parents' attention, would be my guess. It's a classic pop ballad with mellow piano, soft strings, restrained percussion. It features a Yamaha DX7 synthesizer marimba riff, which keeps that Latin sound going there.
Yeah, that Yamaha DX7 is, I think, at some point on the charts, like
every song,
90%. Yeah, like some high number of songs use the DX7.
The song's about unexpressed love, miscommunication. The narrator is unable to convey the true feelings despite being in a kind of romantic partnership. And it ends with the singer sort of accepting that departure, but acknowledging the unresolved emotional connection, you know, the never able to really say what you feel. And this shows Gloria's songwriting and vocal ability. And I think that's what I like about this particular song. And it sort of shaped her career as a later as a solo artist. But when it became clear that her voice could potentially be the star of the show, it didn't have to just be the beats and the dance and all that stuff.
Yeah. Apparently, there were two like main vocalists early on. Oh. And then it became kind of more Gloria's show. And then, you know, with this, she's, you know, submitting a song that she wrote herself. And then I think by the next album, she's penning more songs. And then eventually it's Gloria Estefan and the Miami Sound Machine. And then eventually it's just Gloria Estefan.
Sounds kind of like the Stevie Nicks story, you know?
Yeah.
In some ways. Part of a collective and then working your way up the ladder to the point where you're out on your own. And yeah, it's a pretty song. Ballads have a better chance of being less dated sounding than straight up pop, just because there's a little less of the audio technology of the time. They're relying on it less for the song.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, rock and roll doesn't have that, you know, that problem usually, because it's still just guitars and drums. And but with dance music, you know,
well, yeah, when we heard Body to Body, it's like just about anyone would go like 80s.
All right, well, let's listen to the final cut. Here's Surrender Paradise.
This kind of sounds like trying to do a Chaka Khan kind of. This reminds me of more of an R&B kind of sound of that time again, you know, of the mid-80s.
So this one, again, was written by that songwriting team of Carr, Dermer, and Galdo.
Galdo, Geraldo, Faldo? Not many people will get that, but look it up.
It has a, you know, kind of a tropical paradise theme. You can definitely, you know, feel it in the music, but also in the lyrics. You know, mentions of tropical breezes and starlit skies, crystal blue seas. Yeah. But it's the idea of romantic surrender, you know, so surrendering to paradise and love.
Unlike Words Got in the Way, it's more theatrical, kind of a little cornier.
Yeah, kind of more atmospheric, though, I think.
Yes, I guess that's what they're trying to do, is paint this picture of this tropical romance as the closer, which makes sense. Instead of a more heartfelt, straightforward song, like, they're definitely intentionally sharing the flavors of Miami with us.
Yes. Well, it's time to rewind and reflect on the album as a whole. I'll start off with my clickbait headline. After 40 years, album nerd finally shakes his body and does the conga. So, yeah, even though I was a kid, very young when this came out, I thought it was lame. I don't know why I thought that or whatever, but yeah, I've really kind of warmed up to this kind of thing. You know, the 80s cheese production actually kind of works for me now. I appreciate
it. It's nostalgia probably to some degree. It's comforting. It's comfortable to think back on your youth and you hear these songs and you can picture those days of your life when you don't have to go to work and make decisions and shit, you know?
Yeah. But, what listening to it with a more critical ear, I really find that it's an interesting dance pop record. Yeah. And I think listening to the Pet Shop Boys over the years, it kind of, warmed me up or it was like the doorway into this sound. I mean, there's a couple of moments on there that I think are pretty innovative.
Yeah. I mean, I had a similar experience with this as well. It was cool to me because it was on the top, on Casey's Top 40 or whatever, until my parents started buying the cassettes. And once you see your parents do the conga, you're out. You know what I'm saying? So I'll describe the album briefly with my clickbait headline. Florida heat, 80s synths, and a conga you can't unhear. Primitive love helped define a decade. It's upbeat and colorful, relentlessly danceable, and has that 80s gloss, that mid-80s gloss where, like I said, we really started to establish that neon era. that day glow, I think they used to call it. Era of pinks and yellows and very, very tropical feeling.
Yes.
So yeah, it fits that neon lit Miami dance club mood. And it's a fun listen when you're in the, mood for 80s pop or Latin flavored pop. The Latin part, I think, is what makes it more interesting than some of the other hits of the era.
I agree. As far as killer to filler, you mentioned you can't unhear it. So not only conga, but Bad Boys.
Yeah.
Falling in Love, it just stays in my head for hours.
Falling in Love, and those are ones that are a little more traditional pop songs, I'd say, era-specific pop songs. The Bad Boy one, it's so bubblegum, not bad, and boys will be boys, bad boys. I mean, it gets stuck in your head. It's a great pop groove and attitude, but it definitely, I remember at the time thinking it felt less edgy than Nasty Boys by Janet Jackson.
Definitely.
Where those are the guys you got to be on the lookout for. These bad boys don't sound too bad. But yeah, as far as fillers go, Mucho Money and Movies. Again, I'm really trying to keep this in perspective of when this was, what this is supposed to be, and it's supposed to be fun. So I'm trying not to be too hypercritical about goofy lyrics and things.
The Mucho Money kind of grew on me just as a dance track because, silly lyrics or whatever, but just
the sound of it,
it just kind of creates that immersive sensation of the dance floor. So I came to like that one. Movies, that's probably the weakest track. You Made a Fool of Me is the other ballad, which is solid as well. Actually, one of my favorite moments is on the title track, Primitive Love. I don't know, just a kind of a weird refrain in the middle. I need. I don't know. There's some interesting, synth lines in that one.
Okay.
A lot of killer for an album that maybe we wouldn't be super excited about usually.
Yeah, and in perspective of my standard taste, this is not
right.
I'm not going to be rocking this all the time on my own. But it was a nice visit to that 80s Florida sound. So replayability, yeah, if I'm in the right mood.
When you want to shake your body.
Come on, check your body, baby. Do the conga. When I was a kid in school, that was like a tongue twister we would try to do. Stuff.
Yeah. I'll revisit it. Yeah, and then the legacy, I do think this really, kind of opened the door for more Latin sounding music on the charts. I remember that group Exposé, coming a year or two later, and then the John Secada, all that stuff. And so it sort of established that Latin pop sound, modern dance pop fused with Latin melodies, horns, and percussion.
This is the Miami sound as made by The Machine. And it's flashy, it's multicultural, and it's beach ready. So they accomplished something special here and helped open people's ears to some new sounds in the 80s.
Well, Primitive Love Endures is both a soundtrack of its era and a milestone that reshaped the possibilities for Latin music in the global pop landscape. Check it out.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
All right. It's time again for Deep Questions by Don. All right. Well, we talked about, you know, one cool thing coming out of Florida in the Miami Sound Machine.
Well, there's like 30 cool things of the people in the band.
That's true. What are some other cool things that came out of Florida?
I'll say cool things again. I think that'd be cool. A bunch of stuff, right? I mean, there's cultural things. There's the whole Mickey Mouse, yada, yada, yada. I'm hoping to never attend a Disney theme park.
Yeah, me too.
Unless the Disney folks want to sponsor us, in which case, I'll change my mind. One of the first things that came to mind, of course, was a television program from the era, Miami Vice.
Yeah.
Which fits really well with the album we just talked about in terms of Miami becoming a focal point of stylized visuals, fashion, and the music. Pop artists like Phil Collins, Glenn Frey, and the Miami Sound Machine all appeared on the show at times. And it helped define that MTV generation look we were talking about, the pushed up sleeves, the pastel colors, all that stuff. And it really helped cement Miami's image as both dangerous and glamorous. You know, it was a hard hitting cop show at the time. Edgy. The bad guys were pretty nasty. The good guys crossed the line, you know. Starred Don Johnson and Philip Michael Thomas, and aired from 84 to 89. So I think you can find it on the streamers. One other thing I wanted to mention really quick was Gatorade, invented in 1965 at the University of Florida to help the Florida Gators football team stay hydrated.
It's got electrolytes.
Gatorade.
Yeah, it was originally a mix of water, salt, sugar, and lemon flavor, and it became a world sports staple. When I was a kid, it was in a glass jug, and I got to have it once. It was too expensive. We just drank Kool-Aid. But I was sick one summer for a couple of weeks, and that was how I got my electrolytes, because I was throwing everything else up. So thank you, Gatorade. Wow.
Do you remember the one Gatorade commercial where it had the athletes like sweating, but they were sweating Gatorade? That was so weird.
It was black and white, but then their drops of sweat were the color of whatever Gatorade they were drinking, like blue. The red would have been the most disturbing, but yeah. What about you, Don?
Well, I was thinking about a lot of, you know, TV shows and movies that were set in Florida. For some reason, I went to the Golden Girls, which I feel like was at St. Augustine or something like that.
I don't know. I never really enjoyed the show.
Oh, really? But very witty show.
I'll take your word for it. I really never seen it.
And at the beginning of the show, you made a reference to Scarface there, which was which was shot in Miami. But let's talk about food.
Me want food.
Got to get the food in.
Yeah. So key lime pie comes out of Florida. Of course, it's made with key limes, which come out of, you know, the Florida Keys.
Yep.
Which actually that hadn't occurred to me before. But you a fan of the key lime pie?
Yeah. 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 It's tasty. It's refreshing somehow. For a
pie.
Yeah,
it really is. It really is.
And for those Dexter fans, which also takes place in Miami, I keep mentioning the show, you'll know what the perfect key lime pie is. I don't recommend it.
All right. Well, what's your favorite thing about Florida? Let us know on our social media, like Instagram and Facebook at Album Nerds.
Okay. So I kind of went with a very dude-like selection, took the easy road. With Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, who were formed in 1976 in Gainesville, Florida. The lineup being Tom Petty, of course, on vocals and guitar, Mike Campbell on lead guitar, Benmont Tench on keys, Ron Blair on bass, and Stan Lynch on drums. They earned a reputation as one of the great American live bands while also influencing the era's heartland rock movement alongside Springsteen and John Mellencamp. We're going to be talking about the 1979 third album from the band called Damn the Torpedoes, produced by Jimmy Iovine and Tom Petty. It was released October 19th of 79 via Backstreet MCA Records. Stormed to number 2 on the Billboard 200, achieved triple platinum status in the US. And there's there's a lot of background here. Tom Petty was in a legal battle with MCA after Shelter Records, which was the label they were on, got absorbed, and he lost all publishing rights and creative control. He declared Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and during the stalemate, he self-funded making of this album, and he had a guy hiding session tapes and not telling him where they were, so legally, in court, he didn't know where the tapes were, and they were basically strong-arming MCA that eventually relented, letting Petty launch his own Backstreet Records under MCA and regain his publishing rights. So I think some of what was going on there is in these songs. That's why I mention it. But it's been hailed as Petty reaching his full potential. Why don't we jump in with the opening track, Refugee. Could be about, you know, what was going on with the labels. Big opener combines the stomping groove with the soaring chorus. Petty blended conversational and poetic phrasing. And while it's often seen as a relational song, it also, like I said, I think reflects those struggles with the legal disputes and all that. It originated from a Campbell chord progression, and Petty added lyrics and melody. Jimmy Iovine, in the production, he emphasized precision, and I guess they had 100 to 200 takes to perfect the sound, especially the drums, which were tuned looser for the punchier tone.
Yeah, it sounds like it caused a lot of stress in the studio. Supposedly, yep. Stan Lynch was fired during the sessions and then rehired.
Wow.
Mike Campbell left for 2 days to get away. But I guess, so they really struggled with the drums, I guess. And then, so they had the studio drummer, Jim Keltner, in there with the shaker.
Okay.
You know, which yep. actually, listening on headphones, I noticed it for the first time. But I guess that provided the groove element that they couldn't figure out
before. Kind of like a metronome.
Yeah, basically. Or a cowbell.
Yeah, they needed some cowbell.
I always liked how he turned have into two syllables. Right?
Ha-F! Wait, yeah. Ha-F!
That's are you hiccuping or are you singing? I know what you're talking about, yeah.
Very cool song. I like the kidnapped, tied up, taken away, and held for ransom line.
Yeah.
Very cool lyrics.
There's that, I don't know what it is. I mean, there is obviously a Dylan-esque component to deliveries and stuff, but it doesn't sound put on. It just sounds natural. Especially on this album, Tom Petty's vocals go up. He stretches, he pushes it. There's some frazzle. Yeah. And I think they really put in the work on this one. This is one of those cases where the producer pushed them over the edge because their first two albums were not huge.
Mm-hmm.
They were struggling. He guided them. And he had worked with Bruce Springsteen and others in the past. So he definitely had the right pedigree to be working with this band and pushing them to the next level. Why don't we continue on with one of my favorite songs on the album? I mean, there are so many. They're all great. But let's listen to a little bit of Even the Losers. This is one of those Springsteen-y songs, in my opinion, that definitely feels like Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band could do, and that whole everyman, even the losers, we all, you know, get lucky sometimes, and I think kind of talking about themselves as a band. But it blends that youthful nostalgia of themes of the underdog. I think this comes up a lot, especially in this type of music. I love the sound of it. How'd you feel about this one?
Yeah, I like it a lot as well. I read that Mike Campbell struggled to come up with a guitar solo for it. And so Petty, this is all legend, so who knows if it's real or not, but Petty supposedly asked, what would Chuck Berry do? And so as soon as he asked him that, I guess Campbell nailed it.
That is a Chuck Berry-esque guitar solo. Yeah, I hear that, if it's true.
Then there's a weird clip at the beginning. It's like a woman asking or just saying, it's just not the normal noises in here.
Yeah.
And apparently that's Campbell's wife, Marcy, in their home demo studio.
Oh.
And I guess he was complaining about the washing machine noise, and that was her response.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I wondered about that. All right, Don, so the choices are fairly open here on this record. What stuck out to you? What song did you want to talk about today?
Well, I figured it was probably a good idea to talk about, you know, one of the big hits from the album, Don't Do Me Like That. So that's another cut that's written by just Petty exclusively. Apparently, it goes back to the Mud Crutch days in 1974. And Tom Petty almost gave it to the Jay Giles band, apparently, which I can kind of see. I can hear Peter Wolf doing that.
That could have worked, but I'm glad that it worked out the way it did, but yeah.
Yeah. So the don't do me like that, I guess is a Southern expression that his father used to use a lot. Basically means, you know, obviously not to mistreat me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, you know, it's basically a song about a man warning a woman not to hurt him like in previous relationships. Unlike Refugee, this one was completed in just a few takes.
That's good to hear. Save a little time on one to make up for all the time spent on the other.
Just, yeah. But it's a, you know, I mean, it's an interesting sounding song. You know, it's not, you know, as straightforward as Refugee. You know, there's a lot going on in there.
That little guitar, bitter new, don't do me like that, bitter new. It's,
yeah.
It's just, it's simple and it works for the particular composition and the vibe of that song. It's a little more casual sounding just in general.
Yeah. It's got that piano rhythm and the, you know, that kind of drives it along.
Yeah. And Petty's phrasing is sharp. It's humorous and pleading at the same time. And it doesn't sound desperate. It sounds more like sticking up for yourself, which is tends to seem like a common theme in Tom Petty's music.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a total earworm. I mean, this one is impossible to get out of your head once it's there. I kind of feel sad right now because we're coming to the end of the album. We always include the opener and the closer. And in this case, I'm sad to see it go. So why don't we listen to a little bit of Louisiana Rain? This one's country tinged. Maybe a little more influenced by that southern roots of Florida, although Florida also seems East Coast at the same time as it's southern. It's an interesting state. But Petty sings of a wandering life, love lost in a storm. It's emotional. It's a little slow tempo for an ending, but it does conjure that southern imagery, and it's swampy and sad and just feels honest and human. And it's nice. It's a good closer. I think it's an effective kind of reflection on life kind of thing.
Yeah, kind of a mellow ending to it, which I like. And I like this version of Tom Petty. And I think later in his career, you get more of this sound.
It's more of like his solo stuff, yeah.
Did you see this was released? Bonnie Tyler did this?
Did she?
Yeah, I forgot to listen to it, but I wanted to check it out.
She recorded it?
Yeah, like right around that. I think I think the first version of this was actually hers, even though, you know, Petty wrote it.
And she's gave it to her, I guess. And she's best known for the Total Eclipse of the Heart, Jim Steinman song.
Yeah.
That's why it sounds like a Meatloaf song. Yeah, I mean, it's a 36-minute album, and a lot goes on in that short time, and we've done our best talking about these four tracks, but why don't we rewind, reflect, and talk about the album as a whole? How about I start off describing the album with my clickbait headline, East Meets West, Florida-bred grit polished in Hollywood, perfected for the masses in just 36 minutes.
Well said.
Thank you. So apparently the sessions were split between Gainesville and Southern California studios. Torpedoes is a dual identity, right? It's got a little bit of Hollywood, a little bit of Florida. It's confident, it's scrappy, emotionally honest, which I think is something that Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers do really well. And all that heartland rock, your Mellencamps and your Springsteens. And even if we go up north to the kind of heartland rock with Bryan Adams, that vibe, and you feel like it's true stories about true life. High point of 70s rock. Overall, love it. I think that was made clear throughout our discussion.
Yeah, I have the, you know, similar feelings. Here's my clickbait headline. Petty and Co. declare there will still be classic rock and roll in the 80s. So, yeah, I mean, because of course you've got the post-punk and metal really, you know, starting to dominate the scene, but you have these artists like Petty and Mellencamp and Springsteen that still sort of focus on the roots of rock and roll.
Yeah, sonically, but in terms of they're still standing up for the
loser.
For the losers, for the real people. And I think that to that extent, there is a tinge of the punk attitude in there.
Yeah.
It's not there in the sound, but I think more in the we the people kind of feel, you know?
Yeah, I think even Petty's voice on these early songs, you know, has kind of a punk rock energy to it, which you don't really get, you know, later in his career. Yeah, as far as Killer to Filler, I mean, this is, I say this a lot, but this is another one of those albums where I don't really feel like there's filler.
I mean, that's the thing with this show. We're not typically picking stuff that we're just going to rip to shreds, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe we should. People like that kind of thing.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Here Comes My Girl, innovative structure, that emotional delivery, very memorable hit song. What about Shadow of a Doubt?
Yeah, that's a fun one, too. You know, kind of high energy, you know, interesting vocal quirks on that one.
Yeah, and Campbell's leads are funkier on that one, I thought, too.
Yeah. That song, You Tell Me, the riff kind of reminds me of Sheryl Crow's My Favorite Mistake.
Mm.
It was like the first thing I thought of when I heard this, you know.
Maybe she was inspired by this. Who knows?
Maybe.
As far as fillers, arguably none. Century City or What You're Doing in My Life maybe feel a little less substantial lyrically, but they rock and they're a great part of the record. So, I mean, nearly every track could have been a single. Mm-hmm. It's all meat. No fat. And I think that's, we've said this before, when your album's 36 minutes and you're a huge talent, bring it, you know?
Yep.
There's no room for filler.
So as far as the production goes, I mean, it's a rock record and it does a good job of still capturing sort of a live energy. And even like you have Tom Petty doing 1, 2, 3, 4 and stuff like that. So it feels like you're seeing a rock band. But then on the other hand, I mean, you can tell it's meticulous, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it is, but they're still simple songs. It's still simple arrangements. It's just getting it right. And maybe because of the era, it still sounds analog and warm. It doesn't feel like something that was chiseled from diamond, like things do now, where they're so clean and so soulless. I feel like it was just making sure the performances were right. There wasn't manipulation to the sounds. It was just do it. I need you to do it this 199th time. You know, there's perfectionism there, but it wasn't messed with. Yeah, this was crafted, but handcrafted.
Yeah. You know, I wonder how it would feel if it was done more in the Rick Rubin style of Wildflowers and She's the One, where maybe they're almost intentionally trying to capture some of the rawness and some of the flaws.
I can't think like that, Don. I just got to take this for what it was for me.
Yeah. Yeah. What if George Martin added some strings?
Yeah, I mean, what if Tom Petty rapped? I mean, we could go down this road in a million different ways. I think it's pretty much a perfect rock album from its time. Replayable, so I'm thinking yes. I listen to this one a lot as it is, and I will continue to do so. You can't go wrong.
Yeah, I think I prefer kind of the late career Petty stuff just personally. And maybe it's just because that's the point where I sort of entered the, you know, the Petty catalog.
I get that.
But as far as like these earlier albums, I think this is a great one to capture that early energy that he had at this time.
I just like the feel of rock then a little bit more because there was still a little more mystery and magic and a little less checking boxes maybe, but legacy-wise, this obviously propelled the band to the top, made them a major force in rock. Less obvious sonically, but spiritually tied to Florida's working class backbone and garage rock origins. That's the way I see it.
Yeah, I agree. And I just think, you know, this helped keep sort of that classic rock sound alive in the 80s while these other, you know, new sounds were sort of dominating the charts.
Everybody's talking about the new sounds. Yeah. Funny, but it's still rock and roll to me. So Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers took the heart of Gainesville and turned it into pure American rock. Damn the Torpedoes is Florida grit with a radio-friendly shine. Check it out.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Okay, well, we've been traveling through the Sunshine State. I picture us on one of those airboats or propeller boats or whatever you call it.
Traveling across the swamps.
Yes, exactly. But did you have a chance to check anything else out and dig it?
Oh, yes. I did a little bit of both. an artist that I've been following for years, independent outlaw country singer named Cody Jinks, just released an album called In My Blood. He kind of blends baritone grit, blue-collar honesty, and some southern rock elements. I guess he started off like a heavy metal bands way back when. But he consistently delivers emotionally weighty, kind of ferocious country albums. This is his 11th studio. It features a dark, soulful sound, as always. Why don't we listen to a little bit of the title track, In My Blood.
In my blood, in my bones.
So that one actually features Charlie Starr of Blackberry Smoke, southern rock band that I also enjoy quite a bit. The highlights of the album include Found, Lost Highway, When Time Didn't Fly, signature Jinx honky-tonk saltiness. It's great. And in a lot of the other albums, he's tackled things like addiction and stuff of that nature.
You've got a long roster of these outlaw guys.
I know it, man. I mean, that's my favorite way to do country, is through the eyes of the outlaws. So with a recent loss, many of them, we've had a lot of celebrities, artists, actors pass away recently. Ozzy Osbourne and his debut solo album called Blizzard of Oz, which was released in the UK September 12th of 1980, March 27th of 81 in the US. I had been wanting to get a copy of this, and I finally did. It's a US jet pressing. This one, it's an older pressing, so it's known for superior sonic clarity because it's on the original mastering rather than some of the reissues, I guess, sound a little flatter. That's record collectors for you. Why don't we listen to a little bit of a very well-known song, Crazy Train. Had to make sure to get a little Randy Rhoads in there.
Oh, my God, yeah.
But yeah, the album features songs like Crazy Train, Mr. Crowley, critical commercial success, and 5 times platinum. Can you believe that? Probably over all of time. But yes, happy to have that one in the collection. That was a Discogs purchase. You know, yeah. It's like buying from a record store you can't go to. And actually, the shipper that sent the record from Florida. So there's the tie right there.
Very nice.
What about you, Don? What are you digging on?
Well, Amanda Shires, who you might remember from The High Women. She was a member of that female supergroup.
Yeah, I think I remember her from Lord of the Rings. Shire.
She has a new solo album coming out on September 26th called Nobody's Girl. It's her 8th studio album, but she's been on like a million different collaborations over the years, including with her now ex-husband, Jason Isbell. I think we recently talked about a Jason Isbell record where he's kind of singing about the divorce. And so on this album, I think we're going to get the other side of the story. So it should be interesting. Here's a song called Away It Goes.
I'll have to listen to those back to back.
Yeah.
This week.
Decide where we land.
Which side we're on. Yeah.
But she's really well known as a great fiddle player, so I'm sure this album has a great deal of that. And then wanted to talk about a documentary series on HBO, which recently came out about Billy Joel. It's called Billy Joel and So It Goes. It's actually 2 episodes. Each is like 2.5 hours long, so be ready for a lot of Billy Joel, but it's good. I mean, you know, I know you appreciate Billy Joel.
Yes, I
think you'll like it a lot. And, you know, you get some sort of the inside story and, you know, some pretty honest descriptions of what was going on. But what I like about it is you just see how naturally talented he is, but also how informed he is by classical music.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's what you're hearing now is the track And So It Goes, which the docuseries is named after. That appeared on the 1989 album Stormfront. Billy Joel is also released a companion piece to the documentary on streaming services, has lots of bonus material and some of the live cuts that you see in the documentary. So again, it's called Billy Joel and So It Goes.
How current is it? Does it address his health issues right now, or was this made before that?
I guess it probably comes up to about a couple of years ago.
Okay.
After he did like the 100 straight shows at Madison Square Garden and stuff. But yeah, Billy Joel and So It Goes. So what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky. Also, don't forget to dig on some other music podcasts, like The Worst Podcast on Mars, hosted by Evan and Amanda, just that explores history and the cultural impacts of albums featured on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's list of 200 definitive albums. So check it out wherever you find podcasts.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, here we go again. It's about the time on the show when I'm reminded of the words of Taylor Swift. And I paraphrase, what a crash, what a rush. Florida is one hell of a drug. That's the first time and last time I will quote Taylor Swift. With that in mind, let's bring out the Wheel of Musical Discovery to see what great state we'll be visiting on the next episode.
Next stop on our Bands Across America tour, Texas. From boundary-pushing art rock and blues-soaked boogie to rich Americana and classic country, you'll be diving into albums that capture the bold, independent spirit of the Lone Star State.
The stars at night are big and bright.
Wait, what is that?
Come on, dude.
Sorry, I didn't grow up with that.
Well, neither did I, but I've lived on this earth and in this country.
I thought you were going to go with all my exes live in Texas.
No, that wouldn't be true. Yeah, so Texas, wide variety of musical magic. So that should be fun. I'm sure we'll find some good stuff there. Hopefully, we'll also find Pee-wee's bike at the Alamo while we're in Texas.
In the basement. Hey, well, what's your favorite record from the Lone Star State? So what else are you listening? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com or follow us on Instagram and other social media at Album Nerds. And visit albumnerds.com to listen to all 301 episodes. And the best way to support the show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you, as always, for joining us here on the Album Nerds podcast. We'll catch you next time in the great state of Texas.
Come on, spin your records, baby. Do the... I forgot what my next line was. That was a good start, though, right? Come on, spin your record. Listen to the Album Nerds. You know you can't... Damn it. That's really hard. Come on, spin your records. Listen to the Album Nerds. You know you can't... Nah, damn it. I need the shaker. I know.
Well, nice try. Swing and a miss, but A for effort.
I'm sure your classmates in third grade did a much better job.
No. We crashed around the same spot every time. So, see y'all in Texas.